It's my pleasure this morning to be sitting in the centre of Solio, where the sun is shining on us and the sun is shining on me and also on Martin Daniels. Welcome to Boat Radio, Martin.
Thank you very much.
Now, Martin is a new Solioreek because he probably has only just achieved his first year of home ownership here. Tell us how you found us, Martin.
Exactly a year, actually. No, we've been coming back to Mallorca many times. We've enjoyed it. We've stopped in many fincas and all over the island. I love this area because I love the coast, the mountains, and it reminds me very much of the west coast of America, around Carmel,
yeah,
and 17 Mile Drive, and also from Sausalito up to Mendocino. And around Vancouver and up to West Whistler. It's very rugged. It's very kind of... it hasn't got the fog. And it hasn't got the otters. And it hasn't got the kelp. But it's got everything else. But it's got lovely weather as well. So I love this part of the island. More than just the beach and a flat place.
You obviously know America quite well from that description, and you probably will find a number of American accents in this place just to make you feel at home.
I used to work 1 week in five in America for about 4 years. I was jetting across to New York, New Jersey. I was in the publishing industry at that time, and everything happened on the East Coast of America, not on the West. But I used to go to the West Coast for a break. So, no, I do know America well. I love New York, I love Chicago, and we've even got property in Toronto, and we were going to retire, or I was going to retire to Canada, but that didn't happen.
Canada didn't happen, but tell us a bit more about your interesting life, because you're a very young retiree.
Age is but a number. It's a case where I stopped really working in a 9-to-5 corporate world 25 years ago, and I've done big things since then, but the reality is, if you put me into a 9-to-5 job, I'd die. Put me into a Monday to Friday job, I'd probably die. And I didn't like consultancy. People would pay me a lot of money, but I didn't like it. And so I started looking for other things to do, and I decided that I'd got enough money, I didn't need to work. So I just took the big gamble and said, walk away. And I'm enjoying myself, and I'm busier now than I've ever been.
So what kind of life was yours then? I mean, I know that there's a book part of it, there's a corporate part, there's a digital part. I mean, how can we define you? Where can we put you in our map of the world?
I'm just a businessman. I work for Lucas Industries, I work in the oil industry, in North Sea Oil. I've worked as a director of B&Q, I've worked for Summerfield, I've worked for moved all Virgin Atlantic's technology from India to Romania. I've done a lot of things, and I've been in publishing. I fell into publishing quite by accident, and met Annie, and she taught me a lot about publishing. But the reality is that I always remember Jack Charlton saying, when he got the job at Newcastle United, they said, oh, you've landed the job that you've, the dream job for you. And he said, no, I'll be here for 5 years and then I'll move on. Because I'll achieve what I want to achieve in 5 years, and if I stay any longer, I won't actually achieve much more. And it's interesting that most of the industries I've worked in, I've only been there for 6 years. Most of the jobs I've had are about 6 years long. And it's not because they've sacked me, it's because I've wanted to move on. I've got tired of them. I'm a bit of a butterfly.
What about your writing? Where does writing come into your life?
Well, I hate to say this, because it's everybody suffers from dyslexia nowadays. It's like everybody's dyslexic. But I was backward at school. I was a school reject. I left school with nothing. And it wasn't until I was about 40 and I had to do a load of tests for Kingfisher, who owned B&Q, who were looking for progression and succession planning with regards to Kingfisher and main board, etc. And I did a load of psychometric tests, and this guy said, "Do you know you're dyslexic?" And I went, "No." And he explained it. And that was some 30 years ago. And it was only starting to be known then. And so I was never a great writer. I read very slowly. I think in pictures. I talk in pictures. And that is why I look at industries and businesses completely different from, say, an accountant. And I got into writing because we did some research papers for the publishing company. We wanted to get... It was at the time when digitization was just happening in the late 90s, and we wanted some empathy with the industry. So we did some different perspectives and deep research papers with consultants. And I ended up being the kind of managing agent, editor for them. And the problem was that I started writing and they started correcting my English. And I hated that. I hate people correcting my English. I don't like it where I say something in a sentence and then they say, "Oh, that's not correct. You've got to put it this way around." But it gave me the confidence to write. And then when I wrote this big paper in 2006 on digitization, I realized that I can do it myself and I can express myself, and it may not be perfect English in an academic sense, but it gets the message across. So I then wrote, as I said, 2,500 blogs or articles on digitization, media, rights, and everything that was happening in the early part of this century with regards to digitization and media.
How do you define digitalization? I mean, in the sense of, are we talking everything internet-based?
Well, that's an interesting question, because most people think of e-books. Actually, e-books is just a rendition of in most cases, a physical book. It isn't designed and developed to be digital. It usually starts life in a physical form, and all they do is take the physical content and pour it into a digital container. And that has nothing to do with the editorial process, the copy editing, the proofreading, and all the other aspects of the stages of publication. And what we were trying to do was to change the way that the publishing industry looked at digitization right across its business, not just in the end product. And it hasn't happened. Publishers are still very conservative. They do things in bits and bobs, like most media industries. But publishing is different from, say, music, where the end product actually defines the process, or where, in some cases, radio has changed, and television has changed, and films have changed, because the end product has dictated how the product is made and how it's managed. With books, it hasn't. Because the book isn't bust. The physical book still exists, and it's still a perfectly good form. And it's that sort of thing that really interests me. That's very difficult to explain.
No, because it's fascinating. So in a perfect world then, with all the time in the world to develop this, how would you see the development of that? What's your utopia in this area?
My attitude is, if it ain't broken, don't try and fix it. There is absolutely nothing really wrong with a physical book. What we tried to do, I had a venture a couple of years ago that I've just mothballed with Tim Waterston, who the creator of Waterstones. And what we were trying to do was bring back short form, short stories, but for the digital market only. Because, you know, in the Victorian age, you didn't give somebody War and Peace when they just learned to read and say, "Here's 700 pages, can you please read War and Peace?" They would have put it down in the first after the first five pages. They would have got bored. It would have been too much for them. And in the Victorian age, they had penny fiction. And they had a lot of penny serials and short form. Sherlock Holmes wrote tons of short form. And short form has survived a lot in America and in Canada. But we haven't embraced it within the publishing arena because the model doesn't fit. You can't sell a five-minute read. People don't know how to value it. And do you actually sell it as a license or do you sell it as an outright purchase? The ideal model is like a Spotify, where you subscribe to a library of short form and you can dip in and dip out as your interests are around. So we tried to do it. We had a lot of problems.
So this would be Kindle-based then? So somebody would be walking around their Kindle deciding they've got 10 minutes and download a short story?
No. The Kindle inherently is an interim technology.
Interim.
It's transient. It's never going to survive longer than when, as long as it will only survive as long as Amazon continues to ply it. E-ink technology is black and white technology in a coloured world. It's like watching black and white television. It's limited in what it can do. I have in my pocket a stronger computer than I had 20 years ago. And it's in my pocket. It does everything. I don't need even a laptop nowadays. That does
so
my
you
email.
You and your iPhone.
That does everything.
Yeah.
And that itself also can provide significant entertainment. So we can watch films on it, we can listen to music. But you don't want to read War and Peace on that.
No.
Your eyes will go cross-eyed. But you would be prepared to read a short story, like you read emails on there now, you read articles on there. There is no difference to reading a short story on there. And that's what we were trying to bring back. But let's just say there's a... getting hold of the content is very difficult, and not only getting hold of the content, but having a model, a commercial model, that agents and publishers and authors all sign into is very difficult. The problem that we have is that there's infinitum amount of authors out there, there's infinitum agents out there. So you look for a consolidator because you don't have to deal with every single author on a contract basis for every single article. You want a consolidator, and a natural consolidator would be a publisher. But the publishers don't want to do it. It's too hard. It's like getting out of bed.
Now, Martin, we are talking to somebody that is retired who has got an in-depth knowledge of this big subject. I cannot believe you're really retired. So what are you currently working on?
I am occupied at this present moment in time with a group of community people buying a park or transferring a park from Tower Hamlets back to the community. It's a grade listed park on the Isle of Dogs opposite Greenwich. And we're going to take it over under the Localism Act. And it's a fascinating venture dealing with councils. And also, believe it or not, I am doing a similar sort of thing with a big allotment on the Isle of Dogs, which 90 plots on it, and we are taking control of the allotments from the town council, which is, you would think, is simple in this day and age, but it's not, because they don't like losing assets. But so that those are keeping me occupied. I'm painting. I'm walking. I've got a dog. I can't bring the dog to Mallorca.
No, the whole dog issue of Mallorca needs to be sorted. That needs to be a project you need to get underway with. But just remind us how you decided that Solia was going to be the place that you were going to buy a property in.
Well, two things. One, as I said earlier, the actual placement of Solia in Mallorca is absolutely perfect. It's got the mountains, it's got the sea, it's a working town. I don't want to live in a beach town which switches off for 3 months of the year. this is a working town. It's still alive. It's December. It's still buzzing. It's got local craft. It's got local community. It's got. This is what you want. You don't want to be swallowed up in Parma, where you're just basically a little enclave within a big city. This is a total city. It's somewhere you can actually put down roots and feel you belong. And it's got character.
So when you came to look here, did the sea not take you? Or was it the city that grabbed you first?
The sea is always attractive. As I said, the coastline is very attractive. The wildness of the coastline is very attractive. The windy roads across the mountains aren't very attractive. But the tram is attractive and the train is attractive. But no, I think it... we weren't looking in particular for what we've got. Simon Reynolds did a fantastic job and introduced us to what we actually wanted, but we didn't know what we wanted.
Well,
yeah, most people would say, I want a swimming pool, I want this, I want that, I want a balcony. And probably we would have gone that way, but this is perfect for us because it's a lock-up and go, it's big, it's spacious, and it doesn't have the small rooms that most Spanish houses have. These have been knocked through, so it's one big apartment.
So
like
you have
a New York apartment.
I was going to say, you have a Manhattan loft in the centre of Soria.
Yes, very much so. It's massive.
And this is a fine place to display your art.
Oh,
so
yes.
So tell us about your painting.
Well, I've always been interested in painting and going right back to school days, but I never really had the time or the inclination to do it. And then in our apartment in London, we found a storage cupboard next door to our apartment, which the estate office actually ran, but we acquired it. And in there was a 6-foot by 5-foot canvas blank. And I thought, well, I need to fill this in. And we toyed with the idea, well, what shall I paint on it? I haven't painted since I was a child. And I decided I knew what I wanted to paint. It was going to be bold, it was going to be brash, and we were going to put it outside on the back balcony on the wall under the eaves. And when I finished, Annie, to her credit, said, this is good enough to be inside.
You're allowed inside.
It was allowed inside. And from then, I had the enthusiasm, but also the confidence to continue that style of painting, which I have done. And when we moved here last year, I wanted something Spanish. So I did a whole series of Spanish dances, flamenco dances, which was a complete different take on my painting. But I've enjoyed it, and everybody seems to like it, so we will continue.
So are you now moving on to a venture where you'll sell some?
We've had conversations when we were last here with a couple of people with regards to exhibiting and with potentially, yes, selling. But I don't want that to be a driving force. I don't want that to be the reason that I paint. I want it to be a result, a nice result that comes off the tangent of it. And I think I will continue to do probably another 6 months worth of painting, and then we'll decide how and where we take it from there. But we've got an offer of a gallery.
In Soria. In the Luna.
In the Luna.
Of course you have. And so what are you currently working on? What is the image that you're currently working on?
The one I've just finished was a brown bear fishing for salmon on the salmon run in Canada. And so the background was all impressionist, post-impressionist, and the bear and the salmon were Inuit.
Yeah.
So it's a very... I like painting animals as in Inuit and North American style, because...
Can you define that for anyone that might not know what that meant?
Think of a totem pole. Think of the way that the Native Americans or the First Nation Americans actually express their art. It shows the inside of an animal from the outside, and it shows the way that an animal would look, or the how he moves in a different way than just the skin that you would normally paint. What you would normally see is a photograph, a picture of somebody's skin and how their body folds or the clothes fold up. Inuit actually strips that all off and tries to express how the body is made up and what's inside the body, and has a different way of just showing motion. I can't explain.
That's very interesting. Yeah, fine. I think I'm with you. And as far as the whole experience of living here, the one thing that is a sadness to you is that you have to leave your best friend at home.
Yeah, Lottie's in a hotel on a warm floor.
She's having an awful time, your dog.
And I miss her because she lives all the time with me during the week. She follows me around everywhere, literally a lap dog. And she has demands on my time, which means that I've got to take her for a walk in the morning, take her for a walk in the afternoon. But that gets me out and actually makes me do things, which is great. I think the dog is a fantastic thing. The problem is, why on earth do the airlines put such charges on bringing dogs here? And also, not only if we try to bring her by a ferry, it was just like a nightmare trying to work it out. It was just ridiculous. But the cost variance between a human travelling on a plane and a dog travelling on a plane is, I don't understand it.
Is this a project you're likely to get behind and do something about for the dog owners of Mallorca that would like to bring their dogs here?
I'm retired.
I just don't believe it. I think give you a project and you'll go.
No, I think that a logistics company could well actually tackle the problem. You know, the company they use to bring furniture and goods across.
Webs
could tackle it. They would need extra licensing, and they would need some changes with regards to vehicles, etc. But they could do it in a heartbeat, as opposed to somebody like myself doing it. And also, you've actually got to couple it with other transport, because dogs themselves will not justify the cost of trying to set up a business just to bring dogs across. It's not regular. There is not a dog travelling every week or every few days. It's probably 3 1 month, 6 the next month, whatever. You don't know. It's very unpredictable.
I think anyone that's listening to this right now, record the date and the time that we've had this conversation, because in a few months' time we might be talking about the launch of such a scheme, because I think that Martin Daniels has got an awful lot behind him here that he's not completely telling us about all the things that he's achieved. So tell us what your ambitions are for your time in the Solia Valley.
To grow old disgracefully and paint and enjoy and walk and explore, and I just want to enjoy the place. I think you could spend probably a good 10 years here and not see half of what you need to see. There is so much variation, and it's like walking. There are so many walks to have. There is so many places to see. There are so many towns and villages and etc. I just want to grow old and enjoy it, and paint.
And paint. And so you see. And so you see the Solia Valley as your long term future here. This is not just a 5-year plan.
Oh God, yeah. I well, we've been in Bath for 15 years. I still enjoy Bath, and we've been in London for 15 years or more. I see Solia as being on a par, and I also I wouldn't like to be here full time. I don't think I could live anywhere full time. I'm schizophrenic. I'd like to have a change. So if you had me in Solier for 3 months, I'd probably go stir crazy. If you had me in London for 3 months, I'd go stir crazy. But if you had me between the two over 3 months, I'd be thriving. I like that change. I like that variety. And the thing I love about Solier is it's got such variety. You've got everything that you could dream of. Sea, sand, sun, hills, coastline. Okay, what more do you want?
Excuse me, I can't let you off with that one. Hills?
I think
we have mountains. Mountains bigger than Snowdon.
No, they're huge. It's great. You wake up in the morning, you open the shutters, and you just look out on the mountain, you think, this is a view to die for. And I'm in the middle of a town. And it's great. I really love it. There is a downside, obviously, with the weather can be a little bit tad different due to the mountains. But, hey, I wouldn't like to be baking in Parma every day of the week.
Yeah.
So this is great. I love it.
Well, Martin, thank you very much for talking to Boat Radio, because I think that you're just starting on your journey here, and it's very exciting. And I think we need to catch up with you in a couple of years' time to see just exactly what you've done since.
And buy some paintings.
And I'll buy some paintings, and because I think there's so much more that we're going to learn about you. Thank you for talking to Boat Radio.
Thank you very much. And it's martindaniels.com. Martin with a Y.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.